The stories we are about to listen to were recorded live at the Coast Guard base in Ketchikan, Alaska on February 15, 2015. Stories at Latitude 56 is a program based on traditional storytelling. Community members share mostly true stories from their experiences and are mentored to find their narrative, to hone it, and to successfully share it with a live audience. In today's world of enhanced and almost constant digital communication, storytelling is an art form that requires active listening and builds vibrant emotional connections. By exploring creative expression through the art of storytelling, we hope to open a window into the essence of Ketchikan. These mostly true stories are told by Jim Gunther, Derek McGarrigan, Dana Fitzpatrick, Angie Taggart, AJ Schlegel, and Tom Fowler. Stories at Latitude 56 is a presentation of the Ketchikan Area Arts and Humanities Council. The host of Stories at Latitude 56 is Dana Fitzpatrick.
Well, welcome to the first ever Latitude 56 event. This event is brought to you by the Arts and Humanities Council, and we're so glad to have you here to share humanity and share stories and really celebrate all that Ketchikan is. A bit about storytelling. Storytelling is mostly true. So that's it. It's open for a lot of interpretation. We did work with our speakers to try to edit stories so that you'd understand them, so you'd understand really that humanity that's driving the stories and that ultimately they're entertaining. Our event tonight is produced with support by The Moth. The Moth is a national organization, and it's based in New York by a gentleman named George Dawes Green. He's a poet and a novelist, and he had started in his living room in the 80s these storytelling events, and he tried to mimic the back porch of a friend of his in Georgia. So he wanted to create that southern, you know, sultry, hot evening where you tell stories over some drinks, and they were noticing that moths were coming in through the screen porch attracted to the light, and they said a good story is like a moth to a flame. They did help us guide our event and design, and we're really glad to be here to present Latitude 56. So a little bit about our speakers. We have five speakers tonight. You'll hear stories of journey, of love, of loneliness, of awakenings. And the uniting theme for tonight is on an island. And that is open to wide interpretation. So we'll leave it there. What we have asked them to do is hard. And I really want to reiterate that because they were our first participants, our guinea pigs, if you will. So, you know, what they came in to do tonight was, you know, with no framework. And, you know, it is our goal to make this a series and a little bit of an engagement. And every speaker from here will have a frame of reference in terms of what this means, except for tonight's speakers. So thank you for supporting them and for making this a safe environment for them to succeed. We're really excited. Our first speaker tonight is Derek McGarrigan. Derek is out of uniform tonight, but you'll probably recognize him from his street attire in Ketchikan. So please welcome Derek McGarrigan.
Oh, mic check. Okay, so the greatest chapter of my life, it almost didn't happen. I mean, I was born and raised in Ketchikan. I'm 34 now, but I was born and raised here. We didn't do a lot of traveling when I was young. We went on one family vacation where both my mom and dad went. And lo and behold, we went to Disneyland when I was 8, and I got lost on Tom Sawyer's Island. I don't know if I was lost or forgotten, but I went up this rock spiral, came down the other side, and I was missing, really. So that was my only family vacation I ever took. The goal of every person who's from here that I know of is to graduate and to leave and to never, ever come back. Yeah, right? Never come back unless your parents buy you a ticket and they fly you here so you can visit. And then you better have that return ticket in hand because you're not staying. So that was my goal. Graduate, leave, and never return. I left in 98. I went to flight school in Anchorage. I got about 68 hours, and then I dropped out. Man, I'm partially colorblind. I wasn't very good at flying. I was able to find the runway every time I took off, but I wasn't very good at it. So I ran out of cash, so I dropped out. I came back to Ketchikan. I was talking to my grandma Joan. She's a longtime Ketchikan person, too. She passed away many years ago. But a lot of people around who are older might remember my grandma Joan McGarrigan. She was talking to me one day, your cousin's getting married in the Tri-Cities. Do you want to go with me? So I thought about it, and it was really like, it was crunch time, because she was leaving on the ferry to Prince Rupert the very next day. And so I thought about it, and I said, you know, I'm mowing lawns. I'm a big, important guy at work at the borough, you know, pushing lawnmowers around the schools, and I can't lose out on $8 an hour for a day and a half. So I finally said, yeah, I'm going to go. So we, you know, we take the ferry to Rupert. We drive down to Tri-Cities. It's in Washington, if you don't know. It's my cousin's wedding. I show up, and they make me an usher. I'm the worst usher there is. Because, you know, I'm looking good, right? I'm 19. I'm 250 now. But when I was 19, man, I was 195, and I was svelte, and I was yoked, and I looked good. I had hair, you know. I had earrings, and I had, you know, what do they call that? When you didn't dye your hair, but it was striped or streaked. Frosted. I had frosted hair, man. It was glorious, man. I looked like a Backstreet Boy. So I'm an usher at this wedding, and I didn't realize that you're supposed to seat people on the groom side or the bride side. People would come in and I'd be like, hey, who are you here for? And they go, well, I'm here for the groom. I go, they're sitting over there. And they go, all right, who are you for? The bride. I'm like, they're over there. Just go find a seat. And later on, they told me I'm supposed to seat them, but, you know, I know that now. So if you need an usher, I know how to do it. So the wedding happens. The reception's going on. You know, I got to mention that one of the reasons I went south, I'm not proud of it. I wasn't the greatest man in the world back then. Like, I loved to chase girls back then. So the part of the reason of going south was to find some girls. So I went down there. I'm telling you, I mean, honest to God, that's one of the reasons I went. I'm a different man now. Back then, that was me. Now I'm a solid dude, okay? Good guy. At the reception, you know, I'm sitting there. I had some girl I was chasing around, and, you know, she was chasing me around, whatever. And I see this girl. She was serving champagne. And I was like, man, I got to get with her. And that was Christy, who now, 13 years later, if we fast forward, was my wife. So I spent all that afternoon trying to get together with her, to get her number, get to know her. And you got to imagine, man, like, I'm always giving her the stance. Like, you guys, all you single guys or single ladies know the stance when you're trying to pick up on a chick. It's like arms flexed holding a beer, right? And you're kind of like looking around all stoically with your eyes half open, kind of, yeah, hey. Yeah, oh, she looking at me yet? I got to flex really good, yeah. Got to hold that beer and turn just right, get that muscle. Okay, and I had the really glorious delts and traps back then, so I was making sure to flex. And also, I got to add this. I cut all the sleeves off my shirts back then. So, you know, I still do it today. I would show you, but it's ugly, man. I mean, so she ends up being okay with me hanging out with her. Dancing to John Cougar Mellencamp, Hurt So Good. That was our first dance. And it was great. You know, I suck at dancing. I'm really good when I'm drunk, but I suck when I'm sober. And I was in the middle back then, so I was glad she stuck it out with me. We hung out for 3 days down in the Tri-Cities. We went to the fair. I made a complete fool of myself again. Sleeveless t-shirt that said Booty Hunter on the back. But we went on the zipper. I screamed like a little kid. I was terrified. And when they came to town with that little fair this last summer, my wife was like, we're going on the zipper. Just so I can hear you scream. So 3 days we spend together in Tri-Cities. I fly back to Ketchikan. We do long distance for a while. You know, the long distance cell phone or bills, we didn't have cell phones really back then. They were horrible, Nokias. But our long distance bills were really, really high, $500 a month. I'd fly down to Tri-Cities Visitor, fly to Seattle. It went on for a while. We both moved to Bellingham, moved to Ketchikan. Or I moved back. She moved to Seattle. Eventually, we ended up in Anchorage because I was going to try school for the fourth time because I dropped out three previous times in two different locations. So I fly back to Anchorage. She flies up there. You know, we'd been in a relationship for a while. So she was pregnant. And she's not a good pregnant person. Like, I love you, but she's not good at being pregnant. Like, she is very, very sick, has to literally almost crawl places for like 5 months. And we're in a two-story house, so our bedroom was downstairs and the kitchen was upstairs. I'm like, hey, babe, how you doing? And she's crawling up the stairs. I'm getting some water. So I was working at the YMCA at the time, and I wasn't making a lot of money. And all I could think was, I need a career. Like, I need a career now. I want my wife to be able, or she was my girlfriend at the time. She wasn't my wife. But I was like, I'm staying with her. I'm going to marry her because we talked about it. And I was like, I need a job to where she can stay home if she thinks it's okay. Like, that's, I got to have that be an option. So my dad calls and he goes, hey, guess what? Grandma Joan died. So I was like, oh, Grandma Joan, you know, that was hard. So I fly back. I didn't realize how much of an impact she had in my life until I started thinking about the story. You know, she got me down to the Tri-Cities where I met my future wife. And then as I'm needing a job, you know, I'm not blaming this on her passing, but she passed. I come down to Ketchikan again, and I hear the police department's hiring. I'd never had any desire to be a cop. I never grew up, like, wanting to be a superhero or wanting to be the dude that took care of other people. But I needed the job, and I was desperate, man. I was desperate. And so I applied. I interviewed. It turns out I fly back to Anchorage. They call me up, and they go, hey, Derek. I was 21 at the time. And they go, hey, Derek, you want a job? And I go, yes, sir, right away. And I didn't tell them Christy was pregnant because I think they would have not hired me because of the desperate act. You know, like, they know that I'm trying to get this job to support a family, and they weren't going to hire me. So I say yes. And Christy and I have to start the drive down to Haines to get to Ketchikan. I had a 1984 Ford Ranger that was locked in four-wheel drive, and it overheated after 20 feet. It was 1999, I think now. It was 2001 turning into 2002, or right in that time. So it was a 94 Ford Ranger, not a 98, 94. Yeah, and that thing was just glorious. I mean, it was black. The guy swindled me, like, better call Saul. You really got to buy this car because I got four people on the hook waiting to buy it. And if you don't buy it, I'm going to give it to one of them. I go, I'm sold. I'm buying it. Give it to me today. So I go pick that thing up. We're loading the back of the car. We start driving. We get about 3 hours out of Anchorage, 4 hours at Anchorage, and the car just dies. Like, it's gone. You know, all the antifreeze blows out of it. It can't drive forward anymore. Like, something lurched stuck. And we're sitting there in the car. Christy's sick as a dog, man. She's probably thrown up 15 times by now because we had 3 hours in the car. And thank God we stopped so she could throw up outside. And this, I'm sitting there like, what are we going to do, man? Like, I don't know how far we can go. I don't know how far I have to walk to the next town. I don't know how far it is back, really, because I wasn't paying attention to where we were. I go, we're stuck, man. I can't walk to the next town because my lady's pregnant. What if some dude rolls along and decides to make him her lady, man? I mean, So I was like, I'm sticking with her. She's staying with me. I can't walk. I'm staying with her. This old car pulls up, three dudes in it, and they didn't look savory, is a good way to put it. They go, we'll give you a ride to the next town. I was like, All right. So Christy and I get in the car. There's a hole in it, you know, like in the ground, so you can see the ground as it goes by. And it... They're three older dudes, and they probably had six teeth between them. We get to the next little village. It's like a trailer park village thing. And we go, he goes, you just got to come and use the phone. I was like, dude, are you serious, man? Like, you don't have something to bring outside to me? I got to go in your house? And so he goes, no, just come on and use it. And all that was running through my head was something's going to happen in this house. Something's going to happen in this house. Like, if I got to go, Christy, you just get out of this house. You get the car, and you get out of here as far as you can before it breaks down. And so we go in, they give me the phone and a phone book, and I call a tow truck. And he says, yeah, I'll be there in about an hour. Well, laying on the couch looked like the mummified remains of their mother. You know, it was one of those things where it was just like out of a horror story, man. And I'm in there looking around going like, I'm going to get hit over the head with a frying pan and wake up in handcuffs, dude. But the moral of that part is don't judge people because they helped us out, man. They gave us a ride all the way back to our car. We sat in it, waited. Tow truck showed up, towed us to the next city where it was a little beyond where that little village trailer park was. We got a hotel. I have $300 in the bank. And, you know, that's just enough to pay for the hotel. And that's all I have. I'm not going to call my mom. Mom, guess what? I'm 22. I need your help. I was trying to avoid it. We get the hotel. So my buddy drives up from Anchorage to pick us up the next day. I can't pay for the tow truck. I have to sign the title of the truck over to the tow truck driver to pay for the tow. And he was reluctantly, he accepted it. And I was like, thank God. You know, thank God. He accepted my payment of a 1984 Ford Ranger for a tow that probably cost $500, and the car was worth about $100. You know, my buddy is a savior, drives up, picks us up, brings us back to Anchorage, call my mom finally. Mom, you won't believe what happened. Buys us plane tickets back to Ketchikan, and we get back here. 13 years later, we're still here, right? This island, I'm not going to say it doesn't call you back, but it has a way of getting its hooks in you and not letting you out. And that's the truth, man. I mean, I see people nodding their heads. It wasn't my goal to come back here, man. But I want to leave you, you know, with this about what we had to go through. It wasn't our goal to come back. Christy and I came back. We ended up getting married. We have a family. We got three kids. We have a house, you know, a career. And sometimes I just want to give it up and move south. But I know it's stupid to say that at this point in our lives. Goals and convictions change. And it changed from the point of never wanting to return when I was 18 years old in 98 to where now this is my home, and this silly place called Ketchikan is where home is. And, you know, my heart, regardless if it's Ketchikan or somewhere else, will always be wherever Christy is. So I thank you always for going on that nasty ride with me to try to get back here. So thanks, guys.
Next up, we have Jim Gunther, and Jim has many artistic accolades to his name, and when I asked him to name one, and I said, quote, be funny, he said, my children.
It takes a lot of creativity to build children. I'm in a black corridor, and I'm groping around searching for the source of this strange and haunting music that's in my ears. And I can't even see my hands in front of my face, and it feels like they're not even attached to my body. And I close my eyes, and I open them again, but it doesn't make any difference. It's so dark. And for some reason, I decide I'm going to blink three times. And even then, when I open my eyes, I can't see a darn thing. But I've changed my position. I feel like I'm on my back, or I'd fallen into a crevice, but I can still hear the music, the strange, haunting music. And I reach up to hold on to something, and I can feel this warm wooden hand-hewn slats. And the music continued, and I put my hand to my ear, and I noticed I got my earplugs in. I was wearing earplugs so that I wouldn't have to listen to all the pilgrims snoring and coughing and wheezing and flushing the toilets at night. And suddenly all those things came together, and my brain put together this puzzle of where I was and where I would come from. And every morning when I woke up on that Camino, it was the same kind of a feeling. Where am I and where have I come from? And I remembered this was the 14th morning of waking up on the Camino de Santiago, and we had walked 200 miles from over the French Pyrenees and through Pamplona and from Burgos and through countless little villages. And we were on the second floor of an albergue in a town called Castro Juarez. And I took out my earplugs, and then I could hear what that noise was. It was Ave Maria. It was coming on over the loudspeakers in the albergue. Ave Maria. And it was a wonderful way to wake up all of a sudden, but it's still just totally black in there, and I can't see anything. And then I noticed this yellow light on the ceiling of the albergue, and I can see these ancient timbers of oak. And I looked for where that light was coming from, and over in the corner where the stairs came up from the street level, I see this lantern kind of emerge out of the corner. And it seemed to just be hovering in space and illuminating the room in this yellow light. And I looked, and the lantern kind of floated across the floor, and I realized I'm not wearing my glasses, and I reach over and I find my glasses and I put them on, and holding the lantern is this black figure. It was a man dressed in the black flowing robes of a 10th century monk. He had this big black hood over his face, and it was totally obscured. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's the angel of death. And he starts to walk down the row of bunk beds among all the pilgrims who are sleeping. And I notice he's got this rope belt on and this wooden crucifix hanging down. And he's humming along with that Pavarotti. Ave Maria. And that assured me that I'm in a safe place. Everything's going to be okay. And he kind of hobbled down to the end with this lantern out in front of him. And he got to the end where the senora and her beautiful daughter from Spain were. And he shakes their bunk. And he says, despertarse, despertarse, which means wake up in Spanish. Wake up. Buen camino. Time to get up. And then he went through the line of people, the Irish librarians and a guy from Australia and the New Zealander and the soccer player from Belgium. And he went right down the line until he finally got to the bunk next to me where my wife is and my daughter is. And I sit up straight because I don't want to miss this. And this old guy leans over her bunk and he's got his lantern out in front of him and he shakes it gently and he says, buen camino, lady, wake up. And I see my wife kind of open one eye, and then all of a sudden she sits straight up in the air, and her eyes get as big as dinner plates, and she starts to scream. You can see, this great inhale, and she looks over at me, and I'm just rolling on the ground. This is great. What a great way to wake up. And everybody starts to stir, and he comes to me, and he sees I'm already awake, and we shake hands. Buen camino, he says, good road. And he marches back down the aisle and downstairs, and all of a sudden all the lights come on, and Ave Maria comes up real loud, and everybody starts their morning chores, you know, using the communal bathroom and stuffing your stuff sack and getting ready for a day. We'd been walking for 200 miles so far from across the Pyrenees and through these places, and we had 300 more to go. As we walk down the stairs, the last thing you do is you take care of your feet before you put your boots on, and everybody's got blisters. So everybody talks about their blisters. But there was this one poor girl from Holland. She was showing everybody her blisters, and God, it looked awful. She had been a marathon runner, and she had a huge, high tolerance for pain. And yet, Resty, who had been the monk a few minutes before, said, I take care of your feet. I show you your feet, he says. And he walks back in his office, and he comes back a minute later, and this time he's dressed like a surgeon. He's wearing blue scrubs, and he's got his hair in a net, and he's got a face mask on and rubber gloves. And he comes out, he says, I show you your feet. And she said, oh, okay. And she sticks her foot up and he grabs it. And from behind his back, he pulls a handsaw. And he starts to go, he's going to hack her foot off, right? He's only joking around. But she screams and everybody screams and we all run around. And he's laughing and chasing her around with this saw. And this is the way the Camino started. Every morning it was something crazy like this. And as we walked out of Castro Juarez that morning, we walked down this ancient Roman causeway that had been built in the time of General Pompey, the great Roman. And we walked underneath the fortress of Celtic people who had conquered that area even before the Romans. And we had to walk up this very steep road straight to the west, always straight to the west. They didn't believe in switchbacks back then, 1,000 years ago. So straight west it was and straight up the mountain. And once we got to the Meseta, it was 14 miles through the wheat fields. And it was supposed to reach 100 degrees that day, and it was already hot. So we got just to the top of that, and I see this little white Toyota van coming up this hill. I couldn't even believe it. How could he be coming up here? What's he doing? And he pulls up next to me, and he sticks his head out the window, and it's Resty, the guy who'd been the monk and the guy who'd been the surgeon. And now he said, I'm looking for the Australian. He left his cell phone charger in the albergue, and I want to return his cell phone charger. And I thought to myself, well, the Camino certainly provides. And off we go, and we had 2 more miles, and it was getting so hot, and we're on this dusty natural path. We're headed to Fromista. We had 12 miles to go, and suddenly my wife's blisters seemed like they all burst at once, and her feet almost exploded, and she felt so awful, and she started to cry. I've never seen her cry for pain before. And I stopped, and I said, honey, what's the matter? And she said, why did I let you talk me into this? This is not a vacation. This hurts. I want to be on the pool by the Morellis in Portugal. I don't want to be here. And what could I do? I looked at the map. There's no place to go. There's one place between here and Fromista. It was a fountain. which is hopefully where we could get some water in our water bottles. And I said, honey, in about a kilometer, we could come to a fountain. You could take care of your feet. And she stopped, and she took off her boots, and she put on her sandals, and we hobbled on. We came up over a hill, and there's a little grove of young trees. Oh, thank God. And we get to this fountain. It's beautiful. There's a little picnic table and a pool, a little monument with a spigot in it where you could fill your water bottle. This is great, I thought. And so she started to doctor her feet. And then I noticed right down the road, just a tiny ways, was this man in a little blue microbus. And he had set up a table there for the pilgrims where he would sell them apples and oranges and some juice. And he came over. We were the last pilgrims because we were walking so slow. And he saw Barbara working on her feet. And he says, I take her to Fromista. My cousin owns an albergue there next to a medical center. I will take her there. So I gave him gas money, and he picked Barbara up in her backpack, and they got in the car, and he took her to Fromista. And by the time I got there that evening, she had her feet up and a glass of wine, and she'd figured out the next bus road for the next 2 days. She could take buses to the next two and let her feet heal. And it was this blessing again. Wonderful man in the middle of nowhere. The Camino provided again. We were going to Santiago, St. James, Compostela, the Field of Stars. St. James, who was the brother of John, who was recruited by Jesus at the Sea of Galilee, who left his nets and walked away to become a disciple. St. James, who then came to the Iberian Peninsula and tried to convert the pagans, didn't do a very successful job, went back to Jerusalem and was beheaded by Herod Agrippa. And his followers and friends secreted him out of the Holy Land, and somehow he ended up back in Galatia, near Finisterre, which was then the end of the known world, the furthest westernmost place in the continental Europe. And that's where we were going. We were going to there, and we were pilgrims. And as I walked the rest of the way that day, I had my backpack on and my big sun hat and my hiking poles, and I'm walking across the Meseta, and there's nothing but these beautiful golden wheat fields and a blue, blue sky, and it's 100 degrees. And you start to kind of meditate. And I remembered all these lessons that I'd been kind of learning along the trail. And some of those lessons were the Camino will provide. And that I'm a pilgrim. And my pilgrimage isn't going to end in Santiago Compostela. My pilgrimage has just begun. As long as I walk with gratitude in a way that's going to better myself and with a purpose, my pilgrimage is going to go on for the rest of my life. And the Camino never ends. And the Camino always provides. And the last thing I'll tell you about that Camino trip was the first 3 days, my daughter Danielle always walked at a different pace than anyone else. She was always 3 hours behind. She would stop and make drawings and take pictures of the butterflies and read poetry on the side of a medieval bridge. And I would worry to death over her. I'd get to the next village and I'd have to try and save a bed in the albergue. And you don't save beds. It's first come, first serve. And so I'd park out on the cafe corner, and I'd ask every pilgrim, have you seen my daughter? Oh, yeah, she was back there taking a nap or, you know, whatever. And on the third day out, she met this young man from New Zealand, Louis, and they just meshed. They walked at the same pace. They both loved butterflies. And they were always together. And they've been together ever since. She spent last year in New Zealand, and Danielle and Louis are getting married this August. And there she is sitting back there. So I say again, the Camino provides. The blessing that we use when we pass each other is Buen Camino, which means good road, happy journey. So to each of you, I say, I hope you can become pilgrims too and have a great and wonderful journey on your road of life. Thank you.
I would like to introduce Dana Fitzpatrick.
Hard not to reflect on what an island is. And for me, an island has been a point of reflection, quiet, and very often a point of loneliness, and probably more importantly, a start of a journey. I spent most of my 20s in a place of safety. I was very calculated and very deliberate and very career-driven, and I made all the right choices, you know, according to your resume. And I also wasn't happy. In fact, I was quite sad. Call it my eat, pray, love moment, but I left my life and started over. And over a couple of months of some vino and vinyasa, I realized I needed to have a little bit more structure. So the marketing student in me came out and said, you know what? A theme. Then this idea of camp came out. And camp for me was a place of joy and experience with no risk. If you don't like it, move on. You don't have to marry it. So Camp Dana was about saying yes. Archery? Sure. Beadworking? You bet. Glass blowing? Be there on Tuesday. Eventually, that led me to some pretty interesting dating scenarios, including one lad who on our first date said, "Hey, I'm moving to Africa." Great. And on our third date said, "You should come visit." Camp Dana said, "Sure. Sounds great." So as the trip approached, I compared my travel plans for spring break with some of my friends from work who were debating the subtle merit differences between a 4-star all-inclusive Cancun retreat versus a 5-star all-inclusive Cancun retreat. But regardless, I was excited. I packed my passport, my cute underwear, and set off to see my new boyfriend. A couple notes about my new boyfriend. He's cute. He's tall. He's funny. He giggles like a girl, and he swears like a sailor. One thing he does not do well, he does not plan things ahead of time. We decide we're going to go on a safari because that's what you do in Africa. But there's no hotels, no tickets to said safari. But we're told that there's a man named Pierre in a town kind of near a war, and he knows what to do. If we can just get to that town and find, you know, Pierre, we should be fine. A couple notes about me. Through the story, it's going to sound like I'm very high maintenance. This is not true. A lot of this comes down to expectations. So in my mind, I have seen The Bachelor on television. And I have seen The Bachelor when they go to a safari and there's a treehouse and there's billowing clouds and there's balcony with some chilled wine and the giraffes come up and, you know, they eat right out of your hand. And that's what my expectations were. I brought the cute undies. So we take a bus. And for those of you who have traveled in a developing nation on public transportation, you know what I'm getting at. Bus seats aren't gauged in actual seats. They're gauged in half an ass. As in, your other half of your ass has to be propped up against the person next to you. So we head close to the Chad border, who's also under war. And again, Camp Dana says, yes, this seems like a great plan. We ignore the man boarding the bus at the security checkpoints with the automatic weapons. And we say, yeah, this sounds great. During this trip, new boyfriend tells me his theory of dating. He says, you have to take a girl camping before you can marry her. That's when you see her true merit. I think about my cute undies and my treehouse. And there's a live chicken in a Gap bag above me and a frozen fish dripping down fish sauce on me for 10 hours. But I say nothing. Once we arrive, we get a cab and we say we need a hotel because, again, no tickets to said safari. And they take us to a hotel owned by his buddy that he says is nice. Again, I'm really not high maintenance. So the hotel room is a circular enclosure of corrugated steel with a door. No windows, no sheets. No towels, but it's super cheap. Talking with the staff, we say, you know, we'd like to go see the animals. And they say, oh, okay, well, you need a driver. And somehow someone knows someone, and we kind of have a plan. I wake up the next morning to find that something has bitten me. Not once, not twice, all over my left side. I go into the shower to rinse off the itch, turn the wrench to loosen the screw to let the water flow, break it off, come out with my hand towel covering my lady bits, saying, okay, for the record, this is as low as I go in terms of accommodations. Camping. Camping is the bar to see the true merits of a woman. We do find a driver, and they come and pick us up in a dusty blue 1970s pickup truck, and the three of us sit across the front, and we head to the park. And the park is an archway where the road ends. And they said, you need a guide. And we said, okay, that sounds great. So the two of us climb into the back so that the guide can get in. And we start driving for about 45 minutes in a place where there are no roads. It's desolate and it's majestic and it's possibly dangerous. But, you know, those are not things that Camp Dana is thinking about at this point. But as we're driving along, we see a kind of a haze along the horizon. And we see that the rock, it's a rock formation of some sort, like a plateau, and it's low-lying, and it's gray, and it's got some really great texture, and it's moving. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a little flick and realize it's a tail. It was a herd of elephants, hundreds of elephants. We pull up to about 100 meters from them and watch as they move across the cracked earth. Probably the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And after a full day of bouncing around and seeing hippos and giraffes and monkeys, we head back to where the road system starts again and drop off our driver. We found out that the guide's fee is double what we thought it was going to be. And we are out of money. So not enough to pay the driver, who has just spent his entire day showing us the sights. And our French isn't good. You have no way to communicate that. No way to say bank. We used our kind of mock combination of my better understanding of French and my new boyfriend's little understanding of French, but great Pepe Le Pew impression, to say things like, please, bank. And we finally get to a bank, And in the lobby, our hearts are racing as we put our cards in and try his card first, and the connection times out. We try my card, connection times out, and we sheepishly go back to the driver and say, can you not draw a bank? Can we find another bank, please? And we head to another bank. And at the next bank, we strike out again and again. We start saying, well, maybe we should try credit cards. We start frantically putting our PIN in, just hoping that money starts spewing out at us. And we finally make the connection and spits out money. And my boyfriend and I start hugging each other and jumping up and down. Oh, my gosh, we're saved. We're not going to be sold into slavery. And so years later, my boyfriend and I have been on many adventures together. My moment of being a spiritual island led to an incredible journey and a partner. And now we're in Ketchikan, a literal island. And Camp Dana has become Camp Fitzpatrick. He often talks about the many penalties of being married to someone like me and the many times I say yes on behalf of both of us. But the journey of saying yes has continued. Our next speaker is Angie Tager.
You don't know what adventure is until you've been behind an Iditarod sled dog team. Iditarod 2011. Around 6 p.m., I was getting ready to leave the checkpoint of Finger Lake. Before leaving, I was thinking about the trail that was going to come about. It's one of the most treacherous parts of the trail, the steps. The joke is it takes 3 hours to get to the top and 15 minutes to get to the bottom. Before I left on this exciting adventure, I debated whether it would be better to go through the steps during the daylight or during the night. Is it better to see the cliffs on either side of you or to just go in the dark and just react as things happen? Well, it didn't matter because we were going to be going through it in the dark. I knew we made it to the top of the steps when I saw the famous sign that was carefully hung on a tree that said, "Kiss your ass goodbye." I said one last prayer, grabbed onto my sled as tight as I could, and watched as my dog team descended the first step. We went to the right, we went to the left, we went down another step. About 15 minutes later, we came around a corner, and this big floodlight was shining in our faces, and there was a man standing next to it. Kind of confused me a little bit, because here I am in the dark going down this trail with only my headlamp and my dogs, and there's a man with a floodlight. As the dogs and I flew past him, I said a quick hello and turned my focus back to the front of my team and noticed there's a 90-degree turn coming at us very quickly. Being a smart person, I knew that this was not going to turn out so well for myself. So I watched as my wheel dog took the last turn into the 90 and my sled continued to go straight and hit the ice wall that was in front of us. My forehead hit the wall along with my right shoulder and I was thrown off the sled. And my team continued on without me. As soon as I hit the ground, I jumped up as fast as I could, and I ran down the hill after my team. Luckily, when my sled had flipped over, the snowshoes had fallen out, and they had caught the team in the snow, right in front of the cameraman who had just videotaped the most awesome crash of Iditarod. Well, I found out that we had just finished the third step, and thinking the adventure was over, oh, it was long from being over, because the next section of trail looked like somebody had made a luge track. The sled fit perfectly into this rutted out snowy trail. And the dogs, they knew this was going to be a great time because they went as fast as they could down that. I had no way to put on a brake because the whole floor was taken out by other sleds that had passed before me. By the time we got to the bottom, I had spent every last ounce of energy, mentally and physically. About an hour later, we pulled into the checkpoint of Rainy Pass. I took care of the dogs, and then I went, got something to eat, took a few hours of rest for myself. The next morning, I woke up, got the team ready, and was thinking about the next dangerous part of the trail, the Dalzell Gorge. I'm not really sure why the hardest parts are at the very beginning when the dogs have the most energy, but that's just the way the trail works. The Dalzell Gorge is one of the highest points on the Iditarod Trail. It's 5,400 feet. The dogs and I left Rainy Pass right before sunrise, and on the long climb up, I was debating what was going to happen while we were going down through the gorge. I was hoping it wasn't going to be a recap of the night before, but by the time we got to the top, the light was shining, and I knew it was going to be okay because I could see what was going to happen before it actually happened. The dogs and I started down the first steep incline, It was very well packed and very uneven. So, of course, my sled tipped over and I lost my team. Kind of a reoccurring theme for the next couple days. Luckily, the sled stopped. But unluckily, the sled, going down the hill, was wedged up against a tree about this big around and laying off to the side in soft snow. I sat there for a while and was debating how I was going to get out of this predicament. Because, for one, if I didn't get out of there as quick as I could, another team would be following pretty soon behind me. I wasn't sure. And if they were to come along, there's no way that it would end pretty, because the trail was just wide enough for one team, because there was a rock wall on this side and a cliff on the other. So I sat there for a while trying to figure out how I was going to get the sled back up on the trail. And I knew as soon as it got back up on the trail, we'd be off down the trail quickly again. So I used my strength. I was pulling and pushing and all the things I could do to try to get it off. I tried to encourage the dogs to back up a little bit, take some of that tension off. And eventually, I just felt like I didn't know what I could do. So I reached down in the depths of my soul, and I just became this adrenaline-crazed Yeti. And I reached over and grabbed that sled and pulled it up with all my might. And like I said, as soon as it hit that trail, down we went. The dogs and I then went over some ice bridges. We went over areas that were open with water flowing beneath them. We ricocheted off a few trees, went over roots, uncovered areas with no snow. And then we finally made it to the bottom, to the river. Oh boy, was I ever happy. I stopped the sled, jumped off, and gave every one of those dogs the biggest hug and pet that they could ever imagine. And I think they were looking at me like, what's wrong with you, lady? That was a great time. You know, we had a great time going fast through the corners and around things. And I don't know why you were screaming so much. By the time we made it down onto the river, it was about 5 more miles until we made it into the checkpoint of Rhone. And I just got to thinking about how awesome it was that we got through the most dangerous parts of the trail. Maybe not in record time, but we made it safe and sound, and it was all a tribute to the dogs. You just will never know what adventure is until you're behind a dog team of Iditarod dogs.
Please welcome AJ Slagle.
In 1988, I was living in Juneau, and I had the opportunity to take a hike down the Seymour Canal coast on Admiralty Island. They dropped me off about 3 miles north of Pack Creek. I had a 65-pound pack and a double-bit axe and a 338, and started on down the shoreline there. And the trip went well. It was there was a few highlights. The place full of brown bears, so I thought I'd see more than I did, but I did end up seeing one. But whales every day, beautiful area. Ate ducks most of the way down the trail, but whenever I went somewhere, I wanted to see the ridges and the creeks and their sources and the beach. And when I told you I knew a place, I did, just about every bit of it. And so this one day, here I am about halfway down this 36-mile hike, and I looked out on that beautiful day and all that water and the whales jumping, and I thought, there is no way you were going to see it all. It was just, it just washed over me. I was like, whatever you got ahead of you, it better be special, because you don't have enough time. It's just too big. And so I went ahead and kept going, and I arrived at Pleasant Bay on the fifth day. Not too much worse for wear, and was glad to get to my pickup point. And got a nice big buck first day there, and got to eat his heart on the fire that night. Hung out there and hunted the next day. Saw some nice deer and stuff, and there's brown bear sign all over the place. So my third day, I managed to get a nice big buck, and I'd hung both deer right next to my shelter, which probably isn't recommended. And I woke up that night, which was my last night out, and I hear Martin fighting. I'm like, oh, great. You know, here I've got 300 pounds of bait hanging next to my tent. And so I shine a light up there, and there's one on a branch eating the back strap of this deer. I get up, and I get him out of the tree, and So I wake up in the morning thinking everything would be fine, and sure enough, I look up there and the deer's swinging, but there isn't any wind. Now, there's one inside the cavity, and he's eating it too, and I'm like, all right, you got to go. And so I got that taken care of. Well, you know, I want another deer, and I've lost half a back strap, so I'm going to go hunting. So I left, went out, and there's a creek in that area, fairly good size. Reached the border of it, and there was a doe right on the beach, on the shore of it. And I was looking at her, and I don't know how big you are. I don't want to knock you over if you aren't that big. And so she moved on, and I'm standing there. And about 60 feet away, a brown bear started coming down the creek. By the time I got a shell in the chamber, he was right underneath me. If you've never seen one before, that was my first one where I was on the same ground. And the encounter went well. He went on his way. I didn't bother him. And I was so pumped and full of adrenaline, my knees were literally shaking. Whoa! But it was about an 800-pound animal, and he fully embodied the place. You had no doubt who owned that territory when he walked by you. Well, you know, it's kind of a confined area. I better just go back and guard what I got. So I got back to my camp. There's another marten in another tree, and I'm looking at that thing. I'm like, oh, man, I know you've been eating my deer. Well, he stayed there for 3.5 hours. Every time I come by him, he'd hiss at me, you know. Oh, like, you know what, I got things to do, and I don't want to leave you here eating my meat. And so I shot the branch out from under him, and I got this great idea. I'll catch him, and I'll take him home for a pet. Well, the thing hit the ground. He's a little disoriented from the fall, and he's running, looking over his shoulder, and I'm right on him, just a little bit stir-crazy from being out there that long, I guess. But anyways, we're going around trees and root wads and stuff, and he come up out of a hole after I'd lost sight of him, and he's right next to me. I grabbed a hold of his shoulders, and I pull him out, and I'm holding this thing. It's just a blur of claws and fang, you know, and I'm like, what am I going to do with him now, you know? So about that time that thought hit home, he got a hold of my thumb. And I'm like, you know, I look at him, he snapped the nail in half. And I'm like, you know, like, oh, this ain't good, you know. So I threw him, and he took off. And I kind of inspected my thumb, and he'd actually broken the thing completely under the cuticle, split cleanly in half like I'd been with a cleaver. And I had a canine hole on each, on top and bottom of it. And I'm looking at it like, all right, well, that'll heal, you know. I did what I had to, and I come back. Here he is in the same place the other two had been. Well, it took me 5 rounds to get him out of the tree. I'd taken a hold of him. I didn't know what more incentive it was going to take him to leave, you know. And so I took a little stick, and I threw it at him. I hit him right in the ribs, and he just hissed at me. I'm like, well, all right. I got one I can hold on to. Whap! Right on top of his head. So, anyways, solved that. I got everything down there like I needed to. And here come the pilot. And it was a beautiful fall day. Flat, calm, no wind. Probably about 60 degrees out. And here come Ed Keller in there, landed in the bay at high tide. Everybody was kind of wondering how I'd be, you know, and nobody'd seen me in that time but one pilot that stopped in. And so he shuts down the plane, he leans on the cowl of that beaver and says, well, AJ, how was it? Oh man, Ed, you wouldn't believe it. 2 big bucks, huge brown bear, grabbed a little barge, look at my thumb, you know. And he just shook his head and said, let's take you home. Thank you, folks.
I want to introduce our final speaker. Tom Fowler is going to join us, bring us home. Tom.
I had a very good friend who went by the somewhat unlikely name of Royal Snodderly. About 30 years ago, Royal gave me a phone call, and at the time I was living in Los Angeles, becoming the next great rock star. Which pretty much consisted of partying a lot and flying the piss out of my airplane in the Los Angeles basin area and stuff. And Royal called me up, and he was down in a place called Riverside, California, just south of Los Angeles there. And I'd known Royal from Ketchikan here. We were both mechanics, and we're working on getting all our flying tickets and whatnot. And so we talked, and he was lamenting that he was kind of stuck down there, and he was afraid his girlfriend at the time was going to leave him, all sad. And so out of the blue, I just said, well, let's just go home, Royal. And at the time, I don't know why I said that. I was enjoying my life down in Los Angeles, but suddenly in that split second, I was tired of it. I just wanted to go home. And Royal's like, really? And I said, yeah. And I said, I'll come down there the day after tomorrow, and I'll pick you up, and we'll just get you in the plane, and we'll go home. And Royal was like, okay. And I, as was possible in those young days, closed out my life in Los Angeles in 24 hours. I sent my worldly belongings home in a shoebox and gave everything else away, and I flew down to Riverside. When I got down there, here was Royal alongside of the tarmac. He was sitting on top of a brand-new red Honda three-wheeler. Now, the plane I was flying was a Cessna 150, pretty much the smallest of the Cessna fleet in those days, barely room for two. And I was looking at this thing, and I was like, wow. And Royal, I should explain Royal to those who might not know him. He was a man about my size, heavy set, of maniacal energy. The man was light on his feet, much like John Belushi, incredibly fast for a man his size, and he would never take no for an answer, ever. And so I was looking at this three-wheeler, and I was like, okay, that's going with us for the 2,000-mile adventure. We pulled the wheels off. We took the seats out of the plane. We managed to shoehorn it in there. I had the front struts over my shoulder up under the dash, and I realized after we both got in there and we were squeezed in with each of us on our respective sides of the cockpit there, I could not operate the flaps, and I could barely reach the throttle. And I put my foot down, and I said, Royal, we're not flying 2,000 miles like this. After a huge argument, he agreed. We got it back out of the plane, put the wheels back on, called a cab, put it in the trunk, drove it down to a place, and shipped it. Okay, Royal now is really, he's anxious. We can't leave that day. We'd wasted the whole day on this pursuit. The next day we departed. He's all, I got to get home. I've got to get home, buddy. You know, she's leaving me. Okay. I didn't have any radios in the plane. The plane was, to be honest, a piece of junk. And I couldn't transmit. I could only receive on the radios. And he wanted to cut across the L.A. Basin, which is one of the busiest pieces of airspace in the world. A shortcut, and I wanted to go on the backside of the San Gabriel Mountains. And Royal's, no, partner, we'll just stay low and we'll go fast. And we did. So we're hauling across the LA Basin through many zones that we shouldn't have been in, and I can hear people talking, wondering what this airplane is. I can't answer, but I could receive. And we snuck across there, and there was the start of the adventure. Up I-5 we go, watching the semis pass us. And it was it was a very slow plane. It could maybe do 80 miles an hour straight down. It was a long adventure, but we got to Seattle. Like I say, I had no radio, so we were going to land at Renton. The tower in Renton doesn't close till 5 o'clock of those days. And I couldn't go in there because I couldn't talk to him till 5 o'clock. Well, I'm getting low on fuel, and I'm circling south of the field waiting for 5 o'clock to hit so I can go in and land in Renton. Royal's like, I think we're about out of fuel here, you know. Royal's like, don't worry, partner. He goes, you know, these things will glide forever. By the time 5 o'clock hit, I was right there, landed, and I think I had probably a quart of fuel left in that thing. In the meantime, the aircraft had been falling apart the whole way up the coast. We had no starter. We were hand-propping it, taking turns standing in front and swinging the prop through like they do, you know. we got out, so we went over to Royal's dad's house, Leon. We both knew everything, of course. And we get in there, and we took the magnetos in there, and we had them all spread out on his workbench and scratching our heads over it. And Leon came in and looked at it for a few minutes and told us what was wrong with it. And, of course, Royal's like, yeah, okay, Dad, yeah, right. You just drive those jets. And now, I should tell you about Leon. Royal's dad was the senior employee at Alaska Airlines at the time and also one of their senior pilots. And so I was like, yeah, you know, you just drive the jets and leave the mechanicking to us. Well, after another 30 or so minutes there, we realized Leon was right. What he told us was exactly true, and we put the things back together, like he said, and it worked. And so we got out of there and pushed our way up north, you know, just as hard as we could, and we got into a snowstorm. And we were in the valley of the Fraser River there, and it was like flying down a tube because it was snowing right on the top there. And Royal was flying that leg, and we had to get gas in a place called Williams Lake. Now, that airport's about 10 miles from the river to the east there. And we hopped out of there, and we're right on the trees. I mean, right on trees, 15, 20 feet off these trees. It's snowing like crazy. you know, right at the last, Royal says, screw it, partner, we're heading back to the river. As he banks the airplane up on site, I look down, and there's the runway right below us. That's how bad the visibility was. I said, Royal, it's the runway. Oh, geez, we yanked the power off. Land, we're all kind of like, whew, boy, you know, we go in there, still snowing like crazy. The guy in there says, you know, he goes, you're the first guys in here today. And we're like, yeah, you know, we're big Alaska bush pilots. You know, it was no problem. You know, we were both pretty shook. So we sit there for, you know, we're going to stay. We're just like, this is it. We're going to stay. 15 minutes later, Royal, of course, can't sit still. He's like, you know, we got to go, partner. He goes, I'm pretty sure the weather's better to the west. And I was like, okay, you know, you sure? Oh, yeah, yeah. And so we, off we go, right on the trees. And he was right. It did open up a bit to the west. And we proceeded to take another shortcut. We were cutting across kind of a big wilderness area out there, and we got lost. And we kept turning farther and farther north, and we finally hit the road that runs from Prince George over. But we couldn't find where we were at on a map because we were both pretty cheap, and we didn't buy that sectional. And so we were looking, and because I said, well, it's only a little chunk. We'll never need that part. So we're flying over this town, and we're looking, you know, we don't know what town it is. We can't figure it out. So we're flying lower and lower, and we're looking, trying to look at road signs and everything. And I finally see a water tower there, and it says Vanderhoof. And I'm like, oh, okay, all things are known now. We're good to go here. We found where we're at. And on we proceed to Prince Rupert. Royal ran into a friend he has down there. You know, so this big push to get home, suddenly Royal wants to stay in Rupert. He says, partner, he goes, why don't you come back on Sunday and pick me up? This is like on a Friday, I believe, or a Thursday. And I was like, well, okay, you know, I'm thinking, whatever. And I get in the plane, I fly on up to Ketchikan. Sunday, I head back down to pick him up. This is the day before cell phones and stuff. Royal heads out to the airport on Sunday and doesn't realize that Prince Rupert's airport is closed on Sunday. Now, their airport's similar to ours. It's on an island. But the airport's on the opposite side of the island. There's about a three-mile road to where their ferry docks that you have to take, and there was no ferry to get to there. So Royal's running around. He was a fairly tight man with a dollar, you know, and he finally found a sane boat that would be willing to take him out there for $80. Now, $80 was an awful lot of money to Royal, and he was having fits. But he took it. He paid the guys $80. The sane boat dropped him at the other side of the island. Meantime, I'm sitting there waiting at the airport, and I don't know where he's at. You know, I'm like, we have no cell phones. No one knows. And I was just about giving up, and I just taxiing out to take off. And I look along the fence line there, and I see Royal, and he's waving his arms, and he's like, partner, don't leave without me. You know, and he climbs the fence, the security fence. We get in the plane. He's, you know, and he had agreed. He told me he'd pay for my fuel when I came back down and picked him up. So he's like, just fit to be tied, you know. But we get back home. You know, we put the plane away, and Royal says, you know, he goes, life's nothing if it's not an adventure. And he was that sort of a guy, you know. Later in life, I got out of aviation. I went to work for United Parcel Service. Royal kind of got out of the flying end of it, but he became the mechanic at Alaska Airlines, the station mechanic over there. Every morning I would stop, and I would see Royal, and we would talk and visit. And I remember when his dad, Leon, died, and I missed going to the wake. I thought I had more important things to do. And I came in, I talked to Royal in the office, as I did every morning, and we talked about this trip. And I said, you know, sure, sorry I missed. He said, you know, partner, he goes, I know you're a busy man. He made me feel better about it, which he always did. He was really nice that way. And then he said that again to me. He said, you know, he goes, life's got to be an adventure, when we were mentioning this trip. And I walked out, and that was the last time I saw him, because he was gone that afternoon. Life does have to be an adventure. And I realized it was the stuff that I didn't do that I regretted. It was never the stuff that I did. The adventures are all that's left at the end of it, and the stories. And that's what we're doing here tonight. Thank you.